Good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, November 10th, 2015, and this is For the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Tuesday, everybody. It is 50 degrees and very cloudy here in upstate New York. I have no idea what the future holds for us. I haven't looked at the weather yet today, but at least it's not snowing. I say that every day. So where did we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Rebranding GMO, Resistant Consumers, and Synthetic Biology. We looked at some pretty disturbing stuff, but there were two main stories that we covered. And yes, we only did two stories in the whole show. One was called Biotech's New Plan, Nobody Say GMO. And that was all about their new spin on how they are going to crack the kickback they're getting from people about GMOs. And of course, right at the very beginning of the story, they blamed Food Babe and Greenpeace as reasons why Monsanto's name did not have a good ring to it and why the word or the acronym GMO was so poisonous. So their new strategy for spinning all this great synthetic biology and mad science gone mad and get it into you and your kids, and not just in foods, we're talking about products in general. We looked at all kinds of different products like the spider silk that they're going to be making clothes into, as well as all kinds of other things. 3D printed bug protein, remember that? They want to make you think about how wonderful it is and not what's in it. And what's very interesting about that is we have talked at length about how they have been spinning this message of just embracing technology and how it's going to be good for the planet. And, you know, as far as any of the studies go, hey, the FDA, you know, more than half of the studies that are out there have been proven to be either incorrect or non-redacted. And the TPP is going to get rid of all the labeling. So you don't need to know. You don't need to know the country. You don't need to know what's in it because we know what's good for you. So that was very disturbing because they pretty much came out and said that was their new marketing plan. And then, of course, the second story was titled Genomics is About to Transform the World. And they discussed a lot of scary things in there about how this CRISPR technology, of course, can spin entire species into non-existence. And yeah, that's supposed to be a good thing, of course, because they're using it on mosquitoes with malaria. I just saw, as a matter of fact, there was a story that came out yesterday, another big disease that they're battling from the biotech perspective is dengue fever, because dengue is going to take over the world. Well, apparently there's a big outbreak on the island of Hawaii now. So do a search on that. I actually just found a story out of Hawaii 24/7 this morning that's showing 5 or 6 different areas now on the large island, all around the coast, that they believe there are some major issues. So keep an eye on that. Of course, we haven't had a good outbreak or plague in a while since Johnny's measles. So I'm predicting dengue vaccinations on the Hawaiian island in the future, or some sort of CRISPR-Cas9 technology released, and how great it is that Hawaii is an island. So maybe they'll think that they will stay isolated for their little experiment. But be afraid, be very afraid, people, because this is not a technology to be messing around with. One of the other things we saw last week was that there is going to be, at some point in the near future, a changing of the guard in the FDA. We currently have, and who the hell is it? I don't remember if it's Taylor or the other dude, but both former friends of Monsanto. I don't know if they were attorneys or whatever. It's the revolving door. Who is the head of the FDA? Is it Michael Taylor? Michael Taylor, there we go, deputy commissioner of the FDA. So right now they're looking at a new guy to take his place. And he is, I don't think he's been approved yet, but he is on the plate right now for them to take a look at. But in the story that we read, he absolutely 100% is in bed with Big Pharma. And that's absolutely who we want in charge of the FDA, I would think, right? No, not. Considering that a lot of the same technology, and we've established this over the last 6 months, a lot of the same technology that's being used in genetically modified foods, crops, animals, this RNAi, some of this nanotechnology. And there's a couple different things with nanotech, and I don't know if we're going to get into all of it today, but we're going to hit nanotech today a bit. There are nanoparticles, which are not nanobots. They are nanoparticles, very, 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 very small particles of things such as titanium or carbon nanotubes, that type of thing. Then we have nanorobotics that could be made out of some of those substances. And then they also have these DNA, self-assembling DNA nanobots that they're using DNA. They can self-assemble and create these little organisms and then deliver nanoparticle payloads, I believe, is how it works, that then can go in and flip RNA switches. So it gets even worse. So anyway, we've seen all these different technologies at use in plants, animals, quote-unquote pesticides, right? There's the new RNAi pesticides that they're tinkering with that physically flip switches off inside bugs that ingest this food that has these RNA nanobots in them, or whatever they're calling them. I don't know. I mean, this technology is beyond frightening. But when the insects eat this newfangled quote-unquote pesticide, it turns switches off within the insect's body that are necessary for survival. So whether it is it's turning off a switch to produce a protein that's required, or it's flipping off a switch that's required for procreation, it's flipping off switches that within a short period of time, which is the lifespan of that insect will be dead and not reproduce. Now, you know, of course they say it's safe. We have a former Monsanto employee in charge of the FDA. We also have another one who is in charge of the USDA. And so it's mad science gone mad spread across the board with rubber stamping because, hey, the ingredients are about the same, right? They look the same. They taste the same. There's no difference between an apple is an apple and a potato is a potato. Well, Now, we also have a story that came out, and this caught my attention. This was out of the Atlantic, titled, "Is the USDA Silencing Scientists?" Now, we've seen this in a few other places. We've seen also in Canada, I've mentioned this before, back when Fukushima happened and they started getting readings of potential radiation across the Pacific onto the North American plate, a lot of the Canadian oceanographers stood up and said, "Hey, guess what? We are detecting stuff and we're not liking this, and this may become an issue at some point in the future." And when that happened, I think it was Harper, right? Isn't he the one who was just in there before? Harper said, "Hey, guess what? We no longer have any money in the budget for oceanographers on the Pacific Northwest coast, and so we're going to let you all go." And they did. And I just saw very recently, and I need to go back and dig into it, but I saw very recently that there was a gathering of a lot of these scientists now getting together, and I don't know if they're getting ready to blow the lid off of things up there or not, but I want to at least give them a kudos. I mean, we know what happens to people who open their mouths. We've seen, you know, Obama stating that, hey, we're going to support whistleblowers in this country. And now Obama has been known as the largest prosecutor of whistleblowers in United States history. And we've put people like Chelsea Manning in prison for the majority of their lives. We have Snowden forever in exile in Russia, though the EU said that they may give him a refugee status. I don't know if I would trust that, honestly, now with the TPP allowing the long arm of the U.S. law to reach internationally. And remember, we saw that long before with Kim.com down in New Zealand. I remember when that happened, and I thought, how the hell is some guy in New Zealand being extradited? And I don't think that he actually left, but they were trying to extradite him to the United States for file sharing that was happening in another country, even though U.S. citizens were using it supposedly to circumvent U.S. copyright law. You know, our long arm of the law was working with the New Zealand government, which I've been told by friends and family is a big fucking sellout. They didn't used to be, but they are now. In step in line with Australia and Canada and the UK marching all toward the New World Order. But it really confused me at that time how our federal government, not our alphabet agencies, not the CIA, who does international investigations and drug trading, but how our federal government was stepping into another country. So, you know, don't be fooled, because now New Zealand, of course, is part of one of the 12 nations that has ratified this newest revision of TPP. And I don't know really where we are at with that. So now we've had this ratification. What needs to happen? And again, you know what? Please excuse me, because you have to understand, doing shows on a daily basis and with the amount of news that I see, you can only pick one rabbit hole a day to go down to talk about. So this is something for a future day. But I need to understand also with TPP, now that those 12 nations have inked on, does that need to go to Congress? And remember, the fast track was already passed, so there's no arguing. It's either a vote up or a vote down, and where that all lies. But end result is that, and this was a little rabbit hole we just went down, if Snowden... We're talking about whistleblowers. If Snowden goes to the UK, I don't think he's going to be safe. I don't think he's going to be safe at all with Tippy and Pippy, because that gives us the ability to go in there and, you know, pull legal garbage. And it would most certainly, if we don't somehow extradite Snowden, if he went to the UK over to the United States, it most certainly would allow us to spy on his communications, which I'm sure is very difficult at the moment while he's in Russia. Anyway, okay. So now let's get back to the story that I was ready to do. Is the USDA silencing scientists? Subtext, quote, "There is a message if you want to prosper, do not make waves. And I mean, interesting that that is a quote from someone who was interviewed for the story, but we've known that for a long time. That's why, you know, I like to point and scream evil when I see some of this stuff going on, but we've admitted a lot of these scientists that are working on this man's science gone mad are not evil. They are people, though, who by their silence is helping build this machine that is going to enslave their children and grandchildren. Trust me, I worked in the tech industry, and I saw the one day, I just saw that this was coming. I mean, you are working for the multi-billion dollar machine, and you're building your qubit that adds to the rest of the qubits. So it's not like you're doing it personally, but by taking a paycheck and remaining silent as to what you see and the corruption that's going on and the butt slapping, palm rubbing that's happening all under the guise of 21st century wonder has got to be called out. There are two sides to every sword. And yes, there's all the promises of utopia, but that's not the direction we're headed. Anyway, let's get to the story. Late last year, Jonathan Lundgren, a South Dakota-based entomologist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, submitted an article to the scientific journal Nature Wissenschaften. It sounds like some German nature magazine. And it described how clothrioridin, one of the controversial classes of pesticides called neonicotinoids, harmed monarch butterflies. The paper was accepted, and then in February, a supervisor confronted Lundgren. She informed him that the paper shouldn't have been submitted without official approval because it was sensitive. Not long after, the National Academy of Sciences scheduled Lundgren to give a presentation on the effects of genetically modified crops on farmland ecology. And as is customary, the National Academy of Sciences would pay for his travel to Washington, D.C. Lundgren accepted, but didn't complete the requisite agency paperwork, something that's technically against the rules, but not unusual, with scientists instead filing when they return. Lundgren was reportedly boarding the plane when he was instructed to return home and reimburse airfare costs out of his own pocket. In August, the USDA formally suspended Lundgren for all of these transgressions, but according to Lundgren, he wasn't punished for breaking a few rules. Instead, he says, the very agency responsible for America's farms and food punished him for his science. And for anyone who cares about scientific integrity or about agricultural practices and policies with profound consequences for everyday life, it is a disturbing allegation. The potential ramifications extend beyond Lundgren to other scientists who might be discouraged from studying important but politically contentious topics. Ding, 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 ding. Quote, there is a message. If you want to prosper at the USDA, don't make any waves, says Jeff Roush, the executive director of the Watch Group Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. When you do what Jonathan is doing, you do so at your own peril, he says. This past Wednesday, and when was this story written? November 3rd, 2015. So this is from last week. On Wednesday, PEER, which is the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, filed a federal whistleblower complaint on Lundgren's behalf. And according to his complaint, the suspension was part of a campaign of harassment that started last spring after two incidences. First, Lundgren talked to a journalist about the risks of a new genetic engineering technique pioneered by the agribusiness behemoth Monsanto. Then he peer-reviewed a report by the Center for Food Safety that criticized the overuse of neonicotinoids, which are ubiquitous in American agriculture and linked to widespread declines in pollinators. And, you know, like we looked at some of what Dr. Huber said, he's blaming a lot of it on glyphosate. But, you know, I can guarantee you any type of pesticide that's out there that works on the nervous system especially is going to have some effect on the entomology. So I'm not going to rule out neonicotinoid use, especially with its, like they say, they call it ubiquitous use. I mean, it's being used all over, so I'm sure that it has something to do with it. But anyway, that its ubiquitous use in American agriculture and linked to widespread declines in pollinators. After that, recounted Lundgren in a document released with his complaint, quote, "Improper reprisal, interference, and hindrance of my career began in earnest," unquote. He was told not to speak again to the media about those topics, and his human resource department launched a six-month-long investigation of Lundgren's lab, intertwining his staff and reviewing all of their emails in a search for misconduct. And some of his staff were dismissed. Now, are you kidding me? When we see what played out with Hillary fucking Clinton and her email servers and all the bullshit and her forked tongue to weasel her way out. Oh, I bumped my head. I can't testify over the whole Benghazi thing. I mean, this is just a long continuation of bullshit. And we got some guy raising the red flag going, hey, you know what? Some of this stuff is absolutely not in the best interest. I mean, not even of people. He's talking about the bees and the crops. And now they're firing people in his lab. They're searching their emails for miscon. I mean, this is just beyond disgusting. So kudos to The Atlantic for publishing this. And kudos to the public employees for environmental responsibility for filing a complaint. Back to the story. According to Lundgren, supervisors rejected his research proposals, throwing his grant-seeking efforts, which is the lifeblood of any lab, into disarray. And a trip abroad to give a presentation became a red tape nightmare. Slides in his presentation, he was told, needed to be reviewed by at least seven administrators, none with direct expertise in his research. And under the strain, he stepped down as lead scientist on a major project at his facility, which is the North Central Agriculture Research Laboratory. Now, think about that in terms of geography, the North Central Agriculture Research Laboratory, I would have to say is right smack dab in the breadbasket, right about where they're moving the Plum Island labs to. I don't exactly know what state this is in, but that was in Kansas, if you remember. Manhattan, Kansas is where they're bringing all of that biowarfare plant and animal research off of Plum Island to. Right smack dab into the breadbasket and Tornado Alley. Back to the story. Lundgren was even asked to remove his name as co-author from an article titled "The Causes and Unintended Consequences of a Paradigm Shift in Corn Production Practices" in the Journal of Environmental Study and Policy. I believe, he says, that this action raises a serious question concerning policy neutrality toward scientific inquiry, unquote, wrote his co-author, the economist Scott Foste of the South Dakota State University, in a footnote to the paper. Good for him. Of course, it is not yet clear what actually happened. Maybe Lundgren just didn't get along with his boss. That happens. Asked for comment, the USDA declined to discuss Lundgren's case specifically, but said in a statement that, quote, we take the integrity of our scientists very seriously, and we recognize, yeah, bullshit, and we recognize how critical it is to maintaining widespread confidence in our research among the scientific community, policymakers, and the general public. I mean, that was a load of spin if I ever heard one. Here, official policy media person, read this statement. That's what that is. Still, Lundgren is unquestionably accomplished in his field. He has won awards, published dozens of peer-reviewed articles, and been... There's this commercial that keeps opening and closing that moves my text as I'm reading. He's won awards, published dozens of peer-reviewed articles, and has been widely cited by other scientists. And according to PEER, which is the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, he is not alone. PEER has collected allegations by other USDA researchers who haven't yet gone public, but describe pressure not to pursue certain lines of research. The pressure isn't necessarily as egregious as the kind you might find in Lundgren's account, but there are allegations of verbal discouragement and a tacit understanding of what sort of research and behavior is unwelcome. The agency's own guidelines also state that scientists, quote, should refrain from making statements that could be construed as being judgments on USDA or any other federal government policy, either intentionally or inadvertently. Wow, doesn't that leave it just wide open? And that's all subjective. So maybe that's why you need 7 administrators now to approve your work. That open-ended language... Is there any important agricultural research question that doesn't touch on policy seems to invite politically motivated interference with science. Ding, ding. You can do whatever science you like so long as it doesn't have real world implications, says Ruch. That's a curious stance. Some attribute these measures to the heavy hand of companies that profit from controversial practices and hold considerable sway within the USDA. Well, do you think? I mean, the guy who's in charge is completely in bed with Big Agra. He's not going to let anything hurt his future profits, I wouldn't imagine. And indeed, the USDA has relied on industry-friendly interpretations of science in several recent high-profile actions, including approval of the new genetically modified crops. And I would assume that that probably would be the apple, the potato, the sugar beets, and the alfalfa, as well as criticisms of an Environmental Protection Agency neonicotinoid review. For the USDA to say the EPA's analysis was flawed without any evidence to back that up was really disconcerting, said Scott Black, the executive director of the Xerxes Society, a conservation group active in the neonicotinoid debate. For the USDA to stifle Dr. Lundgren's objective and quality research, not to mention casting a shadow over legitimate scientific debate, is perhaps even more so. Others see a less nefarious USDA desire to avoid bitter controversies between industries and activists, at least in public. Yes, of course. Don't, I mean, you know what the official statement is inside. Don't give Food Babe any more fodder to come after us, because the industry is going to make us bazillions of dollars with all this new genetic modification. We cannot give it another black eye. Back to the story. That's why when President Obama took office, he pledged to restore a scientific integrity corroded during the Bush administration. Oh, yes. When government science was routinely distorted to fit political ends. Oh, like when they rubber stamped cloning into the marketplace. Yes. Just like that. And the Supreme Court ruled about not testing for mad cow disease on our farm, this might still be the case. So good story that was out of the Atlantic from November 3rd, 2015, titled, Is the USDA Silencing Scientists? Of course we knew they were. I will link this in the notes after the show. So I have a couple more stories now that have been sitting here for a few days that I wanted to share with you. We talked about something that we found in research back in the 1990s, I believe, early to mid-1990s, we discovered that there was a genetically modified tomato that was released to the marketplace without our knowledge called the Flavor Saver. And I think they were spelled funky too, like F-L-A-V-R, Flavor Saver tomato. And it's really interesting because I hadn't known that at the time. We just discovered that probably within the last few months in some of my research. But back in the early to mid-90s, it's when I first started getting all the weird food allergies that plagued me for about 20 years. And it started with tomatoes. I would get hives head to toe anytime I ate a tomato and drank caffeine at the same time. That had never, ever happened to me before. And it most certainly was the tomatoes that were causing it. So, don't know. It was in a restaurant setting. I worked in a restaurant. I could get all my food half price, and I was a college student. So, you know, figure that one out. But I used to like to eat my tomatoes, and they started to give me a very hard time. But just interesting that now we discovered that there was something on the marketplace. I mean, what an easy way to put it. We read about FDA regulations in labeling GMOs back a few months ago in some of the newest rules. And in a restaurant, they don't necessarily have to tell you. Just going through food service versus, you know, individuals buying produce. So it could have easily been slipped into a large manufacturer's product line. So anyway, let's get to this newest story out of Scientific American, November 2nd, 2015. Here we go. Nutraceuticals, people. I told you this is the way they're going to spin all this. Gene-modified tomatoes churn out healthy nutrients. Yay! We can all get healthier now eating genetically modified tomatoes. Plants engineered to make substances that protect human cells. Oh, yes, it'll make you live forever. Show GMO crops may improve your health. Oh, isn't this just the big psychological spin that we knew was coming? A variety of tomatoes that have been genetically engineered to produce large quantities of potentially health-boosting compounds, including flavanols and anthocyanins, which I don't know what those are, anthocyanins, anthocyanins, have been developed by researchers in the UK. A single tomato of the new variety contains the same amount of resveratrol as 50 bottles of red wine. Holy shit. How could that be good? You know, if one bottle of red wine is good, 50 must be better. And let's put it into a tomato. Oh, my God. A single tomato of a new variety contains the same amount of resveratrol as 50 bottles of red wine, or the same amount of genistein, I don't know what that is either, G-E-N-I-S-T-E-I-N, a compound found in soybeans that is thought to have health benefits, as 3.5 kilograms of tofu. As tomato plants grow quickly and produce a lot of fruit, farming this new variety could be a way to produce these nutrients in industrial quantities much more cheaply than synthesizing them chemically or extracting small amounts from other plant sources. And you know, tomatoes have had some really bizarre incarnations. In a video we watched back probably a month ago or more now about genetic modification, one of the things that they had talked about was the Arctic tomato, or one of the tomatoes that were now impervious to cold. They didn't necessarily freeze. And what they had done was spliced the genes of some Arctic fish. And I don't remember if it was a salmon or a pike or whatever it was. It was an Arctic fish, though, that lived up near Alaska that didn't freeze. And so they took that freeze, non-freezy gene, and they spliced it into the tomato so the tomatoes didn't freeze. I mean, did you know about that one? Because I know I didn't. There was another one way back when, and I don't even remember what the reason, the scientific reason for even looking at this would be, but they had genetically modified tomatoes with cockroach genes as well. And who knows what ever happened to those. So anyway, back to the story. The variety was made by introducing a gene. So this is these 50 bottle of wine resveratrol tomatoes. By introducing a gene from the plant, Arabidopsis thaliana, called ATMYB12, into the tomato genome, and the gene codes for a transcription factor that binds to the promoter regions of the gene encoding various metabolic enzymes. And I mean, I really don't want to get into the science for this because it hurts my head this early in the morning. Let's skip ahead. By introducing additional plant genes, such as the enzyme necessary for the production of resveratrol in grapes, the plants can be engineered to produce specific compounds that are thought to have certain nutritional or health benefits. Quote, the tomato is a wonderful production system. If metabolic engineering is targeted to the end of fruit development, the fruit can serve as a bag in which to accumulate natural products without impacting yield, says this Martin, Kathy Martin, who's leading the study at John Innes Center at Norwich, UK. As well as being a good way to produce large quantities of target nutrients, Martin says that the tomatoes could potentially be sold for consumption down the line. And if the different compounds we have engineered in tomatoes can be shown to protect against chronic diseases, of course, in preclinical studies, we could consider applying for regulatory approval for commercial sales. This we are doing with high anthocyanin tomato juice, which has well proven protective effects. So they already have genetically modified tomato juice out there, or they're working on it. And what's even more interesting is that this woman's in the UK. I thought that a lot of England had banned genetically modified foods. So is this in preparation of the TTIP? Or is this in preparation of the being able to sell that stuff in the United States? I'm not really sure. Disturbing all the same. Martin adds that this ATMYB12 gene could also be engineered into other fruits and potentially certain vegetables, where the products could be accumulated in a storage organ, such as a tuber. This research gives us a better understanding of how healthy nutrients are genetically controlled in tomatoes and maybe other fruits, comments Wu Jones, a senior research scientist at the Agricultural Science Institute at Rothamsted Research. It is a great example of how biotechnology could provide health benefits directly to consumers. Yes, doesn't that seem to be the mantra for the 21st century? It's all about making sure that you and me and I and our kids and our grandchildren are all healthy and will remain healthy. We won't be a tax to the system. They can decide what's healthy for us and provide it to you in a nice, convenient package one of these days soon to be Soylent Green. You don't need to know what's in there. It's good for you. Eat your vegetables. Shh. He adds that the work will further broaden the debate on GMOs in the EU. Well, good. Martin agrees that boosting plants' abilities to produce compounds that are seen as healthy may help improve what? Oh, the public perception of genetically engineered foods. Yes, the battle is on with those resistant, pesky consumers. She says, I think when consumers see a product which offers them a benefit and which could not be derived by natural breeding methods, they will understand much better the potential that biotech crops have to benefit society. Well, bravo on the spin. Pay attention, people. This is their new strategy for turning the tables on all of the dangers of GMO. Make it so it's good for you. Let's show on TV how a brain implant goes well. Let's show in the news how the first little girl with leukemia had live genes snipped out and she's doing really well. Let's start writing articles about genetically modified nutraceuticals that can make the planet healthier in 21st century America and the world with 21st century medicine. It'll be good for all. It's spinning up, and they're going to turn it up now as we see that the director, I talked about this many times, director of the National Institute of Mental Health is moving over to Google Life Sciences Division, and we are now hiring a 21st century Bernays for the federal government to start spinning some of these programs and some of these technologies that are rolling out. Another story came out, and this was just a few days ago, November 6, 2015, out of phys.org. Tomatoes get a boost, and they get antioxidants from nano-sized nutrients. I think this is a totally different story. With the world population, again, listen to the spin. With the world population expected to reach 9 billion by 2050, engineers and scientists are looking for ways to meet the increasing demand for food without also increasing the strain on natural resources. Oh, yes. Such as water and energy and, of course, producing methane as an initiative known as the food, water, energy nexus. Now, I have not heard that initiative. It is an initiative known as the food, water, energy nexus. Ramesh Ralita, PhD, a postdoctoral researcher, and Pratim Biswas, PhD, the Lucy and Stanley Lopta Professor and Chair of the Department of Energy, Environmental, and Chemical Engineering, both at the School of Engineering and Applied Science at Washington University in St. Louis, are addressing this issue by using nanoparticles to boost the nutrient content and the growth of tomato plants. Taking a clue from their work with solar cells, the team found that by using zinc oxide and, you'd like this one, Rode, titanium dioxide nanoparticles, tomato plants can better absorb light and minerals, and the fruit had a higher antioxidant content. When the tomato plant grows, it signals the soil that it needs nutrients, Biswas says. The nutrient it needs is not in a form that the plant can take right away, so it secretes enzymes which react with the soil and trigger bacterial microbes to turn the nutrients into a form that the plant can use. How interesting, too. The plants also use bacteria to get their nutrients, just as our gut does. But as we heard from Dr. Huber, with the ubiquitous spraying of things such as glyphosate, that is a potent antibiotic, the soil bacteria as well as our gut bacteria are damaged, and so they are not properly uptaking nutrients from the soil. Anyway, back to the story. So it secretes enzymes which react with the soil to trigger bacterial microbes to turn the nutrients into a form that the plant can use. And we are now trying to aid this pathway by what? Oh, adding nanoparticles. Yeah, that's going to help. Zinc is an essential nutrient for plants as well as humans and helps other enzymes function properly, as well as is an ingredient in conventional fertilizer. Titanium is not an essential nutrient for plants or for humans, Riala says, but it boosts light absorption or makes things white by increasing chlorophyll content in the leaves, and it promotes photosynthesis, properties Biswas Lab discovered while creating solar cells. The team used, and here's something that we already heard that Monsanto was toying with the spray-on RNAi. The team used a very fine spray using novel aerosolization techniques. Yeah, just what we want, aerosolized nanoparticles to directly deposit the nanoparticulates on the leaves of the plants for maximum uptake. Now, here's a couple things wrong with that sentence. Let me read that one more time. The team used a very fine spray using novel aerosolization techniques to directly deposit the nanoparticles on the leaves of the plants for maximum uptake. Well, one thing we discovered back when we were looking at the spray-on RNAi is that if they sprayed it on, it wasn't genetically engineered into the plant, and whoops, we just got around any FDA regulations, because it can be kind of washed off, and it does sort of wash off after it's made its way into the plant. So how is it going to be any different for regulation when we're spraying nanoparticles onto the plant? Probably isn't. Don't know for sure, but we know how these agencies work. It probably isn't. Spray on is spray on. It's not being engineered into the plant. Secondly, how is a fine aerosolized spray of nanoparticles going to be beneficial for anyone who lives downwind of those nanoparticle sprayed fields? I don't think it's going to be. Even if they say it's heavy, it's still going to fall into the soil. What's going to happen to those nanoparticles of titanium dioxide? Back to the story. Quote, we found that our aerosol technique resulted in a much greater uptake of nutrients by the plant. And probably, didn't we discover when we were looking at easy ways to cross the blood-brain barrier that aerosolized up the nose was probably one of the best ways. Second way would be through the small intestine after ingestion. We found that our aerosol technique resulted in much greater uptake of nutrients by the plant in comparison to applications of the nanoparticles to the soil, says Relia. The plant can only uptake about 20% of the nutrients applied through the soil. And I wonder why that is. Maybe because of all the glyphosate in the soil? Maybe. With the remainder either forming stable complexes with soil nutrients or being washed away with water, causing runoff Yeah. And where does it go? All the nanoparticles into our drinking water, into the groundwater, into the rivers and the lakes and the streams and the oceans. Good job there, Clyde. In both of the latter cases, with the runoff or being washed away, the nutrients are unavailable to the plants. Overall, plants treated with the nanoparticles via aerosol routes, roots as in ROUTES, produced nearly 82% by weight more fruit than the untreated plant. Damn! So basically, we hijacked their photosynthesis system. We made them absorb more light. It's interesting. What are we having a light problem with plants now? Is that why we're doing this? In addition, the tomatoes from the treated plant also showed an increase in lycopene, an antioxidant linked to reduce the risk of cancer. They didn't notice, though. They didn't mention, though, how much lycopene. It also showed an increase in the antioxidant of lycopene, which reduced the risk of cancer, heart disease, age-related eye disorders of between 80 to 113%. Wow. On steroids by adding nanotechnology. Let's go for it. Aerosolized nanotechnology. And previous studies by other researchers have shown that increasing the use of nanotechnology in agriculture in densely populated countries, yes, where they can get away with this and nobody blinks an eye, such as India and China, has already made an impact on reducing malnutrition and child mortality. Of course, it has. These tomatoes will help address malnutrition, says Ralia, because they allow people to get more nutrients from tomatoes than those that are conventionally grown. This study, published online last month in the journal Metalomics, that might be an interesting journal to subscribe to, Metalomics. The team found that the nanoparticles in the plants and the tomatoes were well below the USDA limits. Yes! That's another one of the games. Just like the radiation, let's just jack up the amount and then say it's always well below the level and considerably lower than what is used already in conventional fertilizers. So they're using nanoparticles in fertilizers too. That's a first. I didn't know that. However, they still have to be cautious and select the best concentration of nanoparticles to use for the maximum benefit, says Biswas. I mean, nobody is talking about what happens to the shit once it's in our environment. Oh, it just washes away. Yeah. Great. Realia and the rest of the team are now working to develop a new formulation of nanonutrients. Ding, ding. That includes all 17 elements required by plants and soon to be Soylent Green for you. It's not going to be too much longer. They're going to have it all in a pill. We'll solve the hunger problem. This will give you all of your nutrients in this one little green pill. Quote, in 100 years, he says, there will be more cities and less farmland, but we will need more food. At the same time, water will be limited because of climate change. We need an efficient methodology and a controlled environment in which plants can grow. Dun, dun, dun. So not only is it going to be GMO for your health, and to combat climate change, and to be able to produce enough food to feed our overpopulated planet with not enough water. But it's also going to be nanotechnology. Good old nanotechnology. And not only is it going to be nanotechnology, but hey, we have a new one here, genetically modified pigs. Raise concern about food regulation. No, yes. This is out of Canada, CBC.ca, from November 3rd, a couple days ago. Regulatory system lacks transparency, say critics. Two kinds of genetically modified pigs are on their way to becoming pork on our dinner plates. And if they do, they'll be some of the very first genetically modified animals to enter our food system, along with genetically modified salmon that is also trying to gain regulatory approval. And don't forget, clone beef. Clone beef was long 2008. Rubber stamp doesn't need to be labeled, can already be in the food supply, but we don't quite know. Back to the story, but consumers are wary. And lack of confidence in government's readiness to regulate this new class of food product, researchers and activists say. The genetically modified pigs under development are designed to improve pork production in different ways. Bruce Whitelaw and his colleagues at the University of Edinburgh, again, another UK. See, I really think that they are planning here to take the lid off a GMO over in Europe. At the University of Edinburgh, are developing a pig resistant to African swine fever, a devastating disease with no vaccine or cure that has led to hundreds of pigs being slaughtered in Europe to prevent the spread of this disease. Jinsu Kim and his colleagues at Seoul University have developed double muscle pigs that produce twice as much muscle as regular pigs, resulting in higher protein, lower fat pork. I also remember reading yesterday, I think, or the day before, about, what's his name? The billionaire, the PayPal eBay billionaire, also investing in pigs and the splicing of human genes so they could grow human organs within pigs for transplant. One of the big concerns that critics have about transgenic organisms is the possibility that they could introduce new allergens into the food supply via a protein that is not normally found in organisms we eat, says Greg Joff, director of the Project on Biotechnology at the Center for Science in the Public Interest in Washington, D.C. That wouldn't be a concern for the double muscle pig, because you're adding in a new gene. Well, I'm not going to eat any of this shit. But I'm not saying that that's a completely safe application, but they have different safety concerns, he says. Jeff says the food safety and environmental safety of every genetically modified animal needs to be considered on a case-by-case basis, as the risks vary with each and every one. Yeah, it sure does. And they're not doing any research. Dr. Huber said they're not doing any research on this. Jason Lusk, an agricultural economist at Oklahoma State University, agrees. These are all very different traits that have very different potential impacts. However, most people don't know much about genetic engineering. So I think that makes it hard to discuss this with someone in the general public. And he noted that genetic modifications that researchers are making to pigs are aimed at addressing what we'd all probably agree to be important problems. But there are risks with these technologies. There are risks with every technology. And there are also risks with not approving these technologies. He acknowledged that surveys show that the public has a general aversion for genetic modification and is willing to pay more to avoid GMO products. Yes, those damn pesky resistant consumers. But I don't think it's necessarily a fear of genetic engineering. It is a fear of uncertainty. Yes, it is a fear of man, science gone mad with no testing and seeing what happens once you and your child become the guinea pigs 20 years down the road as you have fingers growing out of your forehead. Health Canada doesn't do its own testing of foods, relying instead on data generated by companies trying to put the foods into the market, which is kept secret. And that is exactly how they do it in the United States as well. Monsanto, Nestle, they all have their own labs and say, yes, it's the same as the non-genetically modified version. It doesn't disclose what it is assessing, nor does it consult with the farmers or the consumers. So shut up and eat it. All right, guys. Everyone have an awesome Tuesday. Stick around. Mr. Kevin Blanche is up next.